From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, a child and family therapist gives tips on how to talk to kids about racism. Then we learn why people today aren't just frustrated about racial justice.
Not only are people dying during the coronavirus pandemic, but an already unequal America is becoming dramatically more unequal in this moment.
Plus, this year's river cleanup had to be canceled, but that hasn't stopped people from doing their part.
Clean water is important. You know, we need people to help us protect it, and we need to keep advocating for more funding because we do have a lot of challenges, even though we're getting better. We still have a lot of challenges to meeting those fishable and swimmable goals.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The nationwide protests against police brutality have put the issue of systemic racism on full display. For many kids, these demonstrations have raised a lot of new questions about race and racism. These can be difficult topics to discuss, but child and family therapist Lakeisha Russell says it's helpful to have these conversations with young children. Research shows that kids can pick up these racial biases as early as 4 years old. To learn more about how to talk to kids of all ages about race, racism, and the current protests, Russell joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
Lakeisha Russell, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you for having me.
So parents raise kids with phrases like everyone is equal or be colorblind, but this is without thinking about tools kids don't necessarily have to navigate racism, especially later in life. So with recent events and protests against police brutality and systemic racism, how can parents address their own biases and unconscious behaviors that we don't necessarily realize kids are picking up on?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think just for parents to do some of that introspection, so some of that self-questioning work, and you know, maybe it's them taking that time out to write down, okay, how am I around this certain group of people? You know, if I'm in these spaces with them in the workplace or educational systems, like how do I interact with them? How do I connect with them? Have I ever said anything that might have been triggering for them or leading them to think, could I be a little racist?
And do you think it's important for parents to recognize, oh, I haven't had any of these kind of conversations with my kids yet? You know, should it be up to the parents to bring this up and not necessarily waiting for your kid to ask about what's happening on the news?
Yeah, because you want to open up that dialogue with your child. And, you know, sometimes if we wait for our kids to come to us with things, you know, it might be years down the line or it might not happen at all. And so I would encourage parents to go ahead and set that groundwork, because what we know to be true is like by age 4, kids are already picking up those racial biases. And so the younger we start, the better. So I encourage parents to have those conversations as early as they possibly can.
So you mentioned by age 4, these behaviors can be picked up. So let's kind of divide up, because kids can range, obviously, in ages. So let's divide things: toddlers, elementary age school kids, and teenagers. So within these three categories, what do you think is the best way to approach these conversations for these age groups? And we can start with toddlers.
Yeah, so with toddlers, what we know is they love stories, right? Or cartoons, shows, things like that. And so I would encourage parents to tap into some of those resources, whether it be books or maybe it's shows that highlights other characters of other ethnicities in a positive light. And, you know, just asking your child, so what do you think about seeing that? Like, do they seem to be treated fairly if it was like a situation involving kids of color in a certain segment? And so just using those kind of tools, whether it's books or if it's TV shows, just of other ethnicities and cultures that are displayed in the positive light. Because again, you want to reinforce that. Just because you don't look like me doesn't mean that I'm bad.
Right. When it comes to elementary age school kids, what is this age range and what do you recommend for a little more deeper conversations compared to what we're talking about with toddlers?
Right. And so typically for elementary age kids, it's usually like 6 years old to like 12 or 11 years old. And I would recommend, you know, just having kind of direct conversations with them in the sense of what have you been hearing in the news as of late about what's going on? How does that make you feel? How do you think we can help? So just asking more developed questions than you would the toddler age. But again, it's age appropriate. It's not so in your face as if you were talking to your teenager about it.
Right. So let's get to teenagers, because with teenagers, is what we're also seeing is obviously kids also want to take part in activism and fight for change. So when it comes to engaging with our teens and yourself as a Black mother, let's talk about some of the differences that non-POC parents would have with their teenagers versus teenagers that come from families that are Black or people of color.
Yeah. And so, you know, you made a good point that I see it now, especially like on my social media. What we see in the news is that teenagers really want to take part in what's going on and be that change. And I would just encourage parents to process that with them, you know, and not be afraid to do that with them. Because again, I feel like this generation will be the change that we've been waiting for, that will help us see these changes and make headway with things changing. And so I would just encourage parents of teenagers just to process that with them and, you know, finding different ways that they can, because sometimes, you know, you don't always need to be at the forefront in terms of like the protesting. Maybe it's other ways that you can like spread the word and just get other people to start changing. Maybe it's something you do on social media where you get your friends together, you have these conversations live where other people are able to tap into them. Or maybe it's starting in your home, you know, maybe it's having those conversations with your parents to help change just how they're thinking about things.
So how can parents make a space for their kids to demonstrate that this is a safe place to freely share what kids are thinking about, even if they don't fully understand what's happening? You know, because parents can decide to want to jump on a topic or control something, sometimes shut it down. And if their kids are reticent to have those conversations, especially in this moment, how can parents really open up a safe space?
Yeah. And I think it's just by parents actively listening to what your child is sharing with you, and just understanding as a parent, like we want to be able to like have all the answers right then and there and be able to create that dialogue. But it's okay just to listen, you know, and absorb everything that they're saying and then come back to things if you're not really sure on how to respond. But just provide that safe space of non-judgment and just actively listening to what your child is sharing with you.
What would you say to parents who may have that first reaction of, no, my kid's too little to talk about this, I'm not going to go down this road right now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would encourage parents, you know, to, if we can dismantle that thinking, because at the end of the day, kids pick up on how we respond and react to situations. And, you know, whether we are doing it consciously or unconsciously, they've already picked up racial biases and standards. And so just for parents to know that our kids are watching how we're interacting with people, every kind of people. And so just to keep that at the forefront, and that it's not a conversation that you have to be afraid of having, because I think we come from that lens of, as parents, we got to know what to say, when to say it, how to say it. But for parents to give themselves that grace to understand, like, we are still learning how to talk about race as adults, even to this day. So it's okay if you don't have all those answers with your kids, but just knowing that the earlier, the better with the conversation is best.
So Black parents are having very different conversations than white parents with their kids around the topic, especially of police brutality, for the teenagers, for the older kids that, and even younger ones that are seeing protests across the country and militarized police. You know, these are very strong images that kids can pick up on. You know, for example, most white children are told the police are safe. You go to them if you're in trouble, while black children are told a very different reality, such as this is what you need to do if you're pulled over or if you encounter. So how can we help kids empathize with this and also model anti-racism behaviors?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think just again, going back, sharing those stories, those historical stories of just the injustices and the inequalities of Black people and white people. You know, if we can just be candid and real and honest about it, and, you know, and not in a way that is scaring kids, because I'm not for scaring kids into like empathizing with others, but, you know, giving them real descriptions or real examples of, you know, your classmate who looks different than you has to go and have different stories told to them about who we deem to be safe in the community. And so how do you think that makes them feel? Because I feel like once we can tackle and tap into the lens of how does it make the other person feel, I feel like that better helps us to empathize and have compassion with others. Because again, it's just you going into their shoes. So maybe it's the parent just having that conversation. Like, if that was you, how do you think you would feel? You know, and the kid might be like, I might be sad, I might be frustrated, you know, give you all these emotion words, and then go into that deeper dive on the importance of equality and justice.
When it comes to the protests, obviously a lot of this was sparked because of the death of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officers and the video, the visceral video that was taken, the 8 minutes, 49 seconds of video. And even if kids see just a snippet of this, whether it's played briefly on the local news or all the videos that have come before this that have been published publicly, depending on the kid's age, and obviously it's a visceral reaction for adults, and mean something different to Black adults, Black kids. How do you talk to kids about seeing those kinds of images? And also maybe just asking, like, did they see it? Because maybe kids saw it, but they're not going to talk about it, but it's something that's etched into their brain.
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think it just goes with, again, having that space for your child to share with you. But what I always encourage parents, because if you've seen the video and you're triggered by it, get yourself regulated first before having this conversation with your child. Because again, kids feed off of our emotions, our energy, our actions. And so for the parent themselves is to get themselves self-regulated first and then have that conversation. And, you know, and I think it's just asking them, especially if they're teenagers, right? Like, hey, did you happen to see the video? And, you know, allow that to be that opportunity for your child to say yes or no. And, you know, for our younger kids, if they happen to be in the room and the news is going on and they happen to see that, I encourage parents to turn it off right then and there and help them process that, you know, because they might be confused and they might be like, oh, well, if they're supposed to help us, why did they do this? Or, you know, or what have you, whatever it might be. And so just opening that dialogue and again, not being afraid to seek professional help, because then too, you know, if your child is constantly worried about their own safety, trouble sleeping, not eating, you know, then it might be time to tap into a therapist to help them process that trauma that they experienced from watching that.
Right, because kids can be resilient and pick up on a lot, but do you think it's also time that the mental health component of our children should be thought of earlier to engage that way?
Definitely, definitely. I'm a firm believer that you don't need to have a mental health illness in order to participate in therapy. Therapy is that tool to help you through those situations when life comes. And so I'm all for parents like having kids in therapy just to develop some of those coping skills they need. And then definitely after like some kind of traumatic event as well.
So as a parent, what other kinds of conversations are Black parents having that you wish other parents, non-Black parents, would know about that go beyond the current highlight of police brutality?
Yeah. And I have so many stories, but one personal story for me, just as a Black mom with a Black son, you know, just when COVID started, you know, everybody like had the mask and things like that. And I remember me and my son were going to the grocery store and I had on my mask, but he ended up having a bandana. And, you know, we're like in the store, just pushing the cart and things. And I was like, oh, I forgot to get this down this aisle. And I was like, wait right here by the cart. Do not move. Stay right here in the vicinity of other people. Because instinctually, what I thought about, you're a Black boy wearing a bandana around your face. And if I'm gonna be honest, you'll be first profiled that you are doing something illegal when you really are not. You're just trying to keep yourself safe because you forgot to bring your mask. And so for me, like, I would like for parents to know that, like, for us as Black parents, we often have to think twice as hard in terms of our kids' safety. And, you know, along those lines, I feel like it comes with that adultification of our Black and brown boys and girls too in our society, which I think often entails that police brutality. And I say that, and again, that could be like for a whole nother segment or whatnot, but you know, my son is a bigger 12-year-old, but again, he's still a boy, he's not a man, but yet society portrays our Black and brown kids as older than what they are.
And so how do you think parents can also advocate for their kids when it comes to the school setting when things are back, quote, to normal? Hopefully the classroom will also be a place where more of these discussions are had.
Yeah. And I encourage parents, show up, pull up, you know, interact with the teacher, stay consistent, stay connected, be engulfed and immersed. And I'm not saying, you know, parents, because parents are probably like, Lakeisha, I got to work and things like that. But I'm a firm believer, you know, whether you got to take a few hours off of work just to show up and be present randomly and then stay consistent with, in terms of like parent-teacher conferences, school events, like show your face and be immersed in that. Because then too, I think that allows the teachers and the school to know that, okay, this parent is willing and able to connect with us and engage with us. So I encourage parents to show up.
And are you hopeful that these different spaces that kids occupy will be changing now that these conversations are being had, not just in people's homes, but on state levels, federal levels, policies are being enacted? So what do you see is the work that needs to be done when it comes to continuously engaging with children about this?
Yeah. And so I'm hopeful that things we will start to see change, just because I feel like with the protest and people speaking up and advocating, that we are starting to see more of a turn, you know, whether it's in the educational system and like you said, on the state and local levels in government. And even I would say with like these Fortune 500 companies, right? Because now they're tapping into us Black people to come and bring and explain and help them process things that's going on. And so I want to believe that there will be some kind of change and some hope for that. But I think what needs to happen though is having more of us in those conversations, right? So if we're talking about diversity and inclusion, we should see people that are the minorities in those conversations. If I can be really, you know, we can just be honest about that, you know, and then having those people, Black and brown folks, show up in those spaces and just helping people to process the emotions of what's going on. And then I think too, for white people to also be willing to learn, you know, whether it's you reading books, it's so many books that talks about racism and things like that within different sectors, you know, systemic racism within education, within government systems. So reading that literature and really applying those tools and techniques, because it's one thing to get these trainings, to be educated and have these consultants come in. But if you aren't willing to actually do that work to change those systems, then all this will be for nothing.
And what would you say to parents now to encourage self-education, but also the education of their kids, no matter what age and what kind of household they have?
Yeah, I would tell parents to continue to be open-minded. you know, and if you need help, it's okay to ask professionals or maybe ask trusted friends or family members that can help bridge this dialogue. And then I'm a firm believer in reading, you know, because again, it's so much literature out there about racism, how to talk to kids, you know, how to make change within systems of systemic racism. And so I would just encourage parents to tap into every possible resource.
Well, Lakeisha Russell, you are certainly one of those resources, and I thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today about this very important topic.
Thank you for having me.
Lakeisha Russell is a child and family therapist at the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can listen to their full conversation at WUWM.com. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Social upheaval has grasped America from coast to coast over the last several weeks. Every expert seems to have their own reasons why they believe that's been the case. And it's hard to wrap up the pandemic, economic anxieties, racial justice, and our elections all in one bundle. That's why Lake Effect's Julian Haida recently called up Northwestern University professor Jeffrey Winters, the author of Oligarchy, to see if there's something we're missing in these conversations.
Jeffrey Winters, thanks so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Julian.
A lot of what's been going on in recent weeks, whether it be coronavirus related or some of these kinds of racial justice protests, have been reduced by pundits, national commentators, local commentators to partisanship. Some have pointed out even that, like, you know, an organization like Black Lives Matter, for example, funnels its fundraising through Act Blue. It's a democratically affiliated PAC. Is it surprising to you that some racial justice activists see their dollars going the farthest, you know, going towards Democratic candidates?
I think there is a disconnect going on within the Democratic Party between where a lot of its base is. So we had the Bernie Sanders wing on the one hand, younger people who were really focused on inequality issues, material issues, household bottom line issues, and that group is still out there and is wondering what piece of the Democratic Party and platform they're going to get going into the convention in Milwaukee. And you've also now got a very serious issue of racial justice, policing, and so on, where someone like Biden is already saying his interpretation of defund the police is not necessarily the same as many of those folks who are saying, you know, we're not talking about not having police. We're talking about changing the way we address issues of violence, inequality in communities, and not just having it be a question of forces being put out there and buying tanks for local police forces, but addressing these issues in a very different way. So I think this mixture of issues going into the fall poses some real problems for the Democrats. And my guess is Biden is going to have to move substantially on the way he's talking about these issues right now.
It seems like people are surprised or caught off guard in maybe the same way that some were surprised that Donald Trump did in fact get elected in 2016, that civil disobedience has arisen. So, you know, where can someone go to no longer be so surprised so often that people are angry?
Yeah. You know, I think the scale and the fury of the protests really struck significant parts of the United States as very, very surprising. And what does that tell us? It first of all tells us that there is a pent up, suppressed level of anger and frustration that we just got a glimpse of. But it also tells us that there's a whole nother part of America that doesn't see it, doesn't experience it, has no idea what the lived experience of people who are not only in the case of Floyd, not only killed by the police, but tortured. I mean, this was actually a case of torture. To suffocate someone over an 8 or 9 minute period is to engage in torture. I don't know if you've ever experienced not being able to breathe, but some people who have nearly drowned know what the panic is like. You're aware you can't breathe, and it is horrifying. And so that was not an outlier experience, and to witness that just tapped into a lived experience of a large swath of the of American population, we saw them pour out. And so that disconnect between sort of, oh my God, where did this come from? Why this sudden surge of activism, and why all the anger, and why the looting, and why the lack of patience? It shows that we have at least two different Americas, one white and one not white, and that needs to be reconciled. And I don't think a commission is going to do it. I don't think you're going to talk this problem away. We're going to have to see actual action. And I think this issue is going to get expressed in the campaign going into November for sure.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM 89.7, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Haida, and with me is Jeffrey Winters. He's a professor of political science and the director of the Equality, Development, and Globalization Studies program at Northwestern University. Now, you mentioned the looting, and I want to ask you about the ways that looting has been perceived. I've seen people from, you know, Twitter activists to even, you know, kind of stoic organizations, you know, very liberal organizations like the Open World Society comparing bailouts that companies got, people got due to the coronavirus pandemic and recession to a sort of state-sanctioned looting. And now, I think a lot of people, when they look at the protests in the street, they don't necessarily think that this is a response to coronavirus. What is your take on that, that some people can legally loot?
You know, what you're describing, Julian, is a way of connecting dots that are in different spaces but are in fact connected. So, you know, what connects these things is who gets what in society? And how, for example, does the government play a major role in redistribution? So, for example, when we do a massive Washington-led Fed Reserve-based bailout of the economy, one of the first questions, I mean, we're talking about taking public funds and distributing them around. And one of the big questions is redistribution going on in a moment like that? And are the wealthy and the powerful able to capture, latch on to, and capture those resources in a way that the average household is not able to do? And so what we saw in the case of the coronavirus economic response was to try to, there was some effort made to try to design this package in a way that was supposed to help the average person, the average household, small businesses. But what we in fact saw was that it supported very large corporations, those who were able to lobby in Washington to get huge chunks and pieces of this. It supported very, very large salaries at large corporations. It pushed stock prices up. So we saw a massive increase in the wealth of the top 50 or so billionaires in the United States at a time when unemployment was reaching staggering levels at the bottom of society. So the extraordinary thing happening in the middle of this crisis is that not only are people dying during the coronavirus pandemic, but an already unequal America is becoming dramatically more unequal in this moment. And at the same time that was happening, suddenly we have this moment of anger and protest. And we had dramatic images of people running into Target stores and other kinds of stores, you know, grabbing tennis shoes or whatever it was they were grabbing, boxes of this and that, and running out with them. And somehow that struck people as outrageous. Although we're talking about crumbs, really. We are talking about people who don't have much of anything running in, seeing an opportunity to grab a few items and run out with them. And that looks very dramatic, and we say, oh my God, this offends our sensibilities of what is just and what a violation of societal norms and so on. And yet there's no anger at the obscene level of redistribution and massive inequality unfolding right under their eyes at the same moment at a level of trillions of dollars compared to the tiny little crumbs of what people were running out of storefronts with.
Yeah, that reminds me of a viral video that I'd play you a clip, but it is so laden with expletives that we cannot play it on public radio. But it is really kind of heartfelt. It's of a woman in Minneapolis who, when reacting to a reporter's question about looting, references the fact that so many Black Americans don't really own much. There's large lines of credit. You talk about some of the stimulus checks that we all got and kind of the hoops that some people had to jump through who don't have necessarily, you know, a bank account or a traditional accountant to get that $1,200 stimulus check. And how, when the reporter asked, well, why would you do this to your own neighborhood? She says, this isn't my neighborhood. I don't own anything. It's all on credit. So when you hear something like that, the idea of property versus debt at a time like the coronavirus and of, you know, racial upheaval, what kind of strikes you as a possible, you know, solution or kind of reframing this issue that is a little bit more accurate to our understanding of winners and losers in America?
By the way, I also saw that that viral video, and it was arresting to watch it. And first of all, just a quick statistic. So if you take the average person in the bottom 50% of the United States and you ask the question, how much total net savings or worth do they have and property? It's not much, but the average African-American has 1/10 what the average white person in the bottom half of the population has. So we're talking about, even among people who don't have much, there's an incredible racial disparity, which is mind-boggling. So that's just a first point that underscores what we saw in that viral video. But also one of the things that woman said at the very end was, you know, you may be outraged by what's going on with the images you're seeing and the anger you're seeing expressed, but her closing line was, you know, a lot of Americans should be glad that what African Americans want right now is justice, not revenge. And what she was actually saying there was that the folks who were protesting were trying to get the United States to live up to the ideals it claims to have, and that if anything, the anger that was being expressed was contained to a justice narrative and not going into a revenge narrative, we're talking about racial civil war at that point. And so she was actually saying, folks, this could be much worse than it is. So be grateful that that things are being directed in the kind of justice direction that they're being directed. I'm a bit pessimistic in the moment. I think the current situation in the United States is that Democrats are very likely to err on the side of being more conservative just because their goal is not necessarily to address inequality in America and racial issues in America. Their goal is to knock Donald Trump out of office. And the view that is prevalent among Democrats is that that can be done not by being, not by in a more radical way addressing fundamental issues in society, but by moving toward the center and by trying to grab as much of the center as possible, suburban, you know, soccer moms or however they're described, who would be frightened by a more radical agenda. So if anything, the goal to retake the Senate and the goal to push Donald Trump out is, if anything, going to downplay this moment as really being one in which the kinds of issues that are exploding in our face today are really going to be addressed. I'm a little bit pessimistic that that's going to happen.
So taking that insight and understanding, for example, what happened in Wisconsin during the primary, discourses around voter suppression, right, the mail-in ballot issue that is such a hot button issue, especially among the American right. What do you expect to happen in November? And what happens if Donald Trump gets reelected and the Democrats realize their strategy may have failed?
Let me offer you a fundamental insight from what we know in political science. And this is a real simple formula. If all of the base, or if a large proportion of the base who were essentially Democrats in the United States showed up to vote and were actually able to vote, the Democratic Party would win across the country, for the most part, on a massive scale at almost every level. And the Republicans understand this, right? So the Republicans know that they need to really energize their base to show up and be very ideologically focused. Everything is at stake. The Democrats have a much harder time for reasons that are very too long to go into in this interview. And when you add on top of that the fact that Republicans go out of their way to suppress the vote. Why do they do that? For the reasons I just said. And by the way, there's very little evidence that Democrats go out of their way to suppress the votes of Republicans in return. This is really something that the Republicans have really refined and are very, very good at. And they need to suppress the vote to win. And so here's what's going to determine the outcome in November. If the Democrats can really get their base to show up and to vote, we're going to see a massive shift in the United States. But if there is not energy for the agenda, for the candidates, then these voter suppression efforts are really going to be what determines the outcome in district after district and contest after contest. And so that's why these efforts really gin up in the lead up to the elections, because we're talking about, in some cases, the vote for Trump in several swing states was as small as 10 or 20,000 votes. That's a very, very small number of votes to swing the entire electoral college for those states in favor of one candidate or the other. So this is something really to keep an eye on for November.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, we can keep going and discussing these topics. Hope to talk to you again soon. Thanks so much for joining us, Jeffrey Winters.
My pleasure, Julian.
Jeffrey Winters is professor of political science and director of the Equality, Development, and Globalization Studies program at Northwestern. He's also the author of Oligarchy, as well as many books on economics, democracy, and inequality in America and abroad. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida. We'll take one last break, then learn about efforts to clean the Milwaukee River. That's when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Each year, several thousand volunteers come to the Milwaukee River Basin to clean up its three waterways. But this year, as we know, is unlike any other. The Milwaukee River Keeper Group coordinates the annual cleanup event, pulling tons of trash from the water that accumulates over the winter months. The cleanup keeps the rivers healthy, the habitats in good shape, and it's an opportunity to connect people to the natural resource. But this year, on what would have been the 25th anniversary of the annual cleanup, it had to be canceled because of concerns over the spread of COVID-19. Cheryl Nen is a member of the Riverkeeper team. She says the cancellation is a big blow to their mission of creating swimmable and fishable rivers. But there are still ways to help. WUWM's Susan Benz spoke to Nen and a number of volunteers who are still doing their part to clean up the river. We hear first from David Thomas, a volunteer with Friends of Lincoln Park.
Of course, the Riverkeeper cleanup is a huge annual event for the city, and I think they've drawn upwards of around 5,000 volunteers. So for Friends of Lincoln Park, it's a small group of people, but the annual river cleanup usually draws in over 100 people. And we collect over 200 bags of trash. We really do a thorough cleaning of all the debris that blows in over the winter. It really makes a difference, but right now it's really hard to keep up with all that trash.
David created an online map of hotspots in Lincoln Park.
The trash tends to collect in a brush that grows along the riverbank. When the park was dredged out in 2015 to 2017, they did a lot of planting of natives along the bank. So there's all these areas of native species, very beautiful in the summer, but they do catch a lot of trash and debris that just blows through. Walking along the riverbanks, just picking up trash is something we're trying to encourage people to do. We're trying to control garlic mustard in the spring as well and protect those natural areas that have been planted along the riverbank. So you'll find a weed out map with some hot spots as well as the trash hot spots.
David says although he wishes he saw more toting and filling up garbage bags, he is encouraged by the number of people he sees enjoying the river.
There are a lot more people in the park enjoying the birds, enjoying the fishing. And so that relationship between the park and the wildlife and the people who visit, I think, has evolved a little bit during the pandemic.
A 20-minute drive to the southwest on the Menominee River, Krista Gensler said she had been looking forward to leading a cleanup crew for the first time.
We were going to be on the corner of North Avenue and the Menominee Parkway in, like, kind of, I don't know if you'd call it western Wauwatosa, but just a little west of, you know, the central area of Wauwatosa.
Up until a couple of years ago, Krista knew nothing about the cleanup or Milwaukee Riverkeeper that coordinates it.
I read about it in the church bulletin, actually. The church bulletin had an advertisement for the spring cleanup. So that's how I first heard about it.
Another way Milwaukee Riverkeeper builds a connection to the waterways is through Adopt a River. Individuals or groups can sign up to clean a specific section of the basin twice a year. Since the big one-day spring event couldn't happen, Krista and a friend have given the spot they adopted a little extra TLC.
So we have a portion of the Menominee River in Wauwatosa still, and it's near Jacobus Park. So we go there regularly, like twice a year, once in the fall and again in the spring, to clean up our portion of the river specifically. This year as well, we just jumped right in when they had to cancel, unfortunately had to cancel the spring cleanup. We said, well, we can just go down there, the two of us, and socially distance ourselves and yet clean up a lot down there. And so we did it twice so far this spring, once kind of just to, you know, check it all over. And then we had gotten such a hard rain that we drove by again and saw that a lot of trash had kind of come up. The river had risen quite a bit. And so there was a lot of trash that was now had come downriver, had just, you know, kind of made its way down. So we stepped in there again and did another, like, I don't know, half cleanup, you might say, because we couldn't get to all of it.
Other than rain boots and waterproof gloves, Krista says her most prized piece of gear is her grabber.
Like you think of with somebody that might have, you know, back problems or bending problems, they have grabbers that you can pick up things from the floor or pick up things from a shelf. So we bought a couple of those and use those, and those are fantastic because you can reach into the river, you can grab plastic bottles, you can grab tiny things. It works out really, really great. So that's a really key tool for us to use. We sometimes wish they extended a little bit longer.
Matt Walter jumped into the annual spring cleanup when he was an undergrad at UW-Milwaukee in the early 2000s.
I was just undergrad and kind of bored, and I saw a flyer up for, you know, the area big cleanup. So I signed up, and a friend of mine was going to do it, but he was only doing it to get extra credit, and I did it, and I didn't get extra credit, and he was just baffled, like, why would I spend my Saturday doing it? But I actually enjoyed it.
Matt has done every Milwaukee Riverkeeper volunteer job in the book. Consequently, he's gotten to know the entire basin pretty well.
I signed up for river monitoring, so we go to sites in the Menominee, the Milwaukee River, and the KK, and then for the river cleanups, there's like, I don't know, 50-plus sites now. I became a site captain at a site on the north side. I was a site captain. I helped with some educational activities, summer events, work in the booth. I've done the Adopt a River program. Now I'm on year three. I have a site along the parkway near St. Luke's. So I go pretty much just myself now, and I it's kind of like the Adopt a Highway, but it's a river. That's some other fun stuff, like they do rain barrels. So I have several rain barrels around my house, and two of the barrels were from rain barrel painting events they had at Lakefront Brewery. I've been partnered up with MMSD, boat rides, kayak events, and then I've done emergent contaminants sampling. I've done that before, after like Thanksgiving and main events.
Eventually, when Matt got married, his wife joined in.
Once a month, we'd go to our site. She would help take notes, and I'd be in the river. And we did that for maybe 5 years total.
And now he's cultivating the next generation of river keepers, his 4- and 5-year-old kids.
Being outside, interacting with nature, I would love to see the changes throughout the seasons and the fluctuations within nature. You really see things differently when you're out along the river and you notice things when you slow down.
I thought at first it might be like a, I don't know, I don't think that is a mess. I think it's just schmutz that's washed in from the river.
I meet Milwaukee River Keeper's river keeper, Cheryl Nen, for a socially distanced conversation on the Milwaukee River off Capitol Drive. Normally she'd be training new people to join Matt Walter and other volunteers who not only clean up, but monitor the health of the three rivers within the basin.
We were going to train 40 people last Saturday at River Edge with River Edge Nature Center. And it's one of my favorite days of the year. It's like classroom in the morning and afternoon, you know, playing in the river for 2 or 3 hours. So we had to cancel that.
Instead, Cheryl says with a laugh,
it's Cheryl in a plastic bag,
which she's almost completely filled in just a short walk.
There's so much plastic trash in particular. Single-use plastic is probably 80% or more of what we pick up. That can be plastic bags, plastic bottles, styrofoam containers, you know, plastic chip bags, cigar bags we find everywhere, the packaging around cigars. Unbelievable amounts of plastic stuff. A lot of that plastic stuff the river will pound away at, and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller into microplastics. And you can really easily see this if you go downstream of like Esterbrook Falls, for example, or downstream of some of the falls in Cedarburg, areas like that. It's more easy to see the microplastic because it's really broken down smaller. So basically what happens is A lot of fish and other aquatic life can ingest this. If they see little, you know, round, small styrofoam white balls, they look like eggs to them, or even other different colors of plastic. They often think that's something that they can eat. It's a, you know, salamander egg. It's a critter that they can eat. And so that is kind of one of the biggest issues with leaving the plastic and the other debris in the water, you know, in the waterways. It doesn't necessarily kill a fish, but it can. It can physically obstruct the biology, the systems there. And, you know, just also, I'm sure, just be probably not very pleasant, but can definitely be a stressor to wildlife and in the worst possible circumstance can kill wildlife.
Cheryl says the Milwaukee River Basin, along with rivers, streams, and lakes around the state, need public support more than ever.
You know, I think a lot of what we do as an organization, I mean, certainly we do advocacy and occasionally litigation, and we're, you know, we're pushing policy to continually improve the rivers and ensure those clean, fishable, swimmable waters that we talk about all the time. But I think the really big thing that we do is really just try to connect people to the water. You know, I think it's so easy nowadays to not be connected to the environment. I mean, I think there's a lot of people that probably drive over rivers multiple times a day and don't really pay attention to them being down there. So I think one of the really positive things about the pandemic, if there is any, if there are any positives, are that, you know, I've certainly been noticing a lot more people walking down by the river. I've had friends, you know, email me that they didn't realize that they had a river trail that close to them, or they had always walked on, you know, the paved trail and didn't realize there was a nature trail nearby. And a lot of people are going out and exploring new parks and new places. And I think that's all really positive. You know, hopefully one of the outcomes of this is that we all recognize that clean water is important. You know, we need people to help us protect it, and we need to keep advocating for more funding, because we do have a lot of challenges. Even though, you know, we're getting better all the time, you know, we still have a lot of challenges to meeting those fishable and swimmable goals.
Since these conversations, riverkeeping is gradually resuming. In early June, volunteers began slipping on their waders to pick up monitoring. Cheryl Nen will begin training small groups of new volunteers. In Lincoln Park, David Thomas hasn't given up on making up for the big spring cleanup cancellation. Friends of Lincoln Park will host its inaugural summer DIY cleanup, June 19th and 20th. Starting times will be staggered to avoid crowding, and Friends members, wearing masks, will hand out freshly sanitized pickup sticks, maps, and bags from a safe distance. People who love their parks and the water that runs through them are determined to clean up and carry on with stewarding the nature humans depend on. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bunce.
Cheryl Nen is part of the Riverkeeper team with the Milwaukee Riverkeeper Group. We also heard from a number of volunteers helping to clean up the Milwaukee River Basin. They all spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Audrey Nowakowski and Julian Haida join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Jack Urbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from LaToya Dennis and Susan Bentz from the WUWM news team this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Matanowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.